You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9. I'm your host, David Gilmore, speaking with Northwest poet Bill Davey again. And we are going to listen to Bill read more of his poems from the Pandemic Suite, which is not always so sweet as you might hear. But Bill, welcome back. We're so glad that you wanted to join us again.
Thank you, David. It was my pleasure before, and it is my pleasure again. So I appreciate
it. Well, wonderful that you could do this again.
Oh, you bet.
And so you mentioned before that there might be in poetry, sometimes people call it graphotherapy or a kind of cathartic experience that comes through expressing and confessing yourself in ways that are literary. Did you feel that helped somewhat in your own endeavors with the word?
Yes, and I would say that that is probably my default position. I would say that that's my primary use of poetry is as an outlet for feeling, and it always kind of has been. I'm kind of that way with my songwriting too. If someone has told me once, Bill appears in all of his works. I am present in what I write. It's kind of the ongoing story of my interaction with life. You know, I'm not trying to be the objective I. I'm always participating on some level in what I'm writing. So,
right.
Yeah.
So listen up, you're going to get the real thing. And this is the real thing. We're going to go to a harbor and you're going to hear some ideas that may twist your head a little bit, but you'll get the feeling for what Bill's talking about here. And he can comment, Will, too, as after he's read. Harbor, Bill. Wonderful
right.
Poem.
Okay. Harbor. I woke up late in gray light because my alarm didn't go off and I wasn't able to go walking in the pre-dawn dark, which is my favorite thing to do. My thinking feels clumsy and slow, like climbing stairs in baggy pants or reciting the dictionary with a mouthful of nails. I am not my best self. Luckily, the world is in quarantine, so very few people are exposed to my limits. Just my wife, the kindest, most forgiving soul. She lets me keep my necessary distance. She knows where my unfiltered mind goes when the moss grows thick on the branches and old fires still smolder in the stumps, all of it rolling toward a dark harbor.
Right.
Yes.
People who think of rolling towards the dark harbor, this has been, as you call it, pandemic suite. It has brought that idea to mind, just how much the whole world is involved in apocalyptic scene, as we've been able to see it in the news. But it seems as though there's an entropic element in so much that happens in the modern day.
Yeah,
we're not about the creative and regenerative aspect, but there's this feeling that we're slipping. There's a slipping that we can't help. We've done it.
I'm not sure that I believe totally that we can't help it, but it does seem to be like that is the evidence that we are presented with kind of day to day and week to week. So I think the pandemic has kind of offered all of us a chance to reflect on all of that and perhaps see it more clearly and in a more unified way than we had been presented it in the past. And I think it's caused all of us to do a lot of reassessing of who we have been and how we have acted in the world and whether that will lead to, you know, any kind of systemic change or not, I guess remains to be seen. But it has certainly been a kind of collective wake-up call, I think.
Right.
To a lot of these trends that you speak of, the entropic trends yeah. that we've been involved with. So,
yes, know. There's much to be learned in how to awake people to consciousness. We still have a large population to awaken. Poems that deal in this troublesome aspect that you've written about too. I think people that have a sensitivity to go to this sort of question of, yeah, I have dreams like that too. I have worries like that too for myself. Oh, my family. It's there for everybody.
Right.
It's there for everybody.
Right. If you have to do is extrapolate from your feelings about your family, and it's not hard to imagine that your neighbor also has the same feeling about his or her family, and so on and so on, to realize that this is a more collective consciousness than maybe we've given it credit for some time, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you write about this problem of putting on your pants, which though it has a humor to it, there's a grimness to this kind of struggle.
Yeah. You want to hear me read Soup, do you? Soup. Alrighty, here we go. Almost fell over putting on pants. Almost fell out of bed while dreaming of putting on pants. Almost, almost, almost. Tire irons and baseball bats floating in the soup. Big chunks of concrete sailing over my head while I complain about weather. This isn't my coat. This isn't my front door. This isn't where I parked the car. We got to get security down here to unlock these handcuffs. We got to cook some soup and invite people over to help with all this brown booze. Everyone's too busy watching football on the TV to notice that criminals are emptying the bedroom. Football is destroying our sense of proportion about bedrooms and TV and handcuffs and booze and tire irons and baseball bats. We got to get more baseball on the TV. We got to get security down here to help me put on pants.
That makes me think about some of the ironies in your songs too. You like to bring up that kind of weirdness.
Well, this is kind of a poem of kind of faux panic, although I'm not sure how faux it is, depending on the day. So, yeah, one kind of ebbs and flows out of a consciousness that can look a lot like that. But I decided to be kind of satiric with it in that particular poem. But
yeah, we don't have a true crow poem in Towards Home, but I think that's a good one to follow with since it's on the next page.
Okay, all right. This one gets into a little bit of a, when the weather is at its warmest, I tend to have a lot more pain associated with my MS. And it also is a fatigue sets in, and so this is kind of written from that time of year, actually written last summer. Mm-hmm. Toward Home. When pain is a companion, at least we're not alone. The morning walk is troubled again, a storm of nerves. We try to forget, to walk tall, but this day rises out of the hollow that grips your right leg, and ease is back home at the writing desk, waiting. Too early for crows, too early for the moon to leave its bed of cloud. Even the streetlights abandon us halfway up the hill. Just past the skeleton of an old tree, the moon takes pity. Comforts us with a three-quarter glow, marking the turn toward home.
Moons are so common in poetry, are they not?
They certainly are. Yes.
How did you come to the idea of using the moon in that one?
Until the last couple of years, I had the habit of walking in the pre-dawn darkness. That was my preferred time to walk because I liked the starlight. I liked seeing the available starlight, and I liked watching the moon as it moved across. I felt like the nighttime was more peaceful for me. There was less stimuli, and so it led to a more of a meditative state. But as my disability has gotten a little bit worse, my sense of balance has become trickier and trickier, and I found that walking in darkness did not give me quite enough physical reference to hold my balance, and I was wandering a little bit. And and one of the things that I have to be careful of is falling down due to lack of balance. And so I had to resort to walking in the early morning light here recently. So the moon most nights was a presence on my morning walk, and that's why it entered into the poems.
Yeah. Well, it has figured so much over millennia of time in the mythology of people and through poetry too.
Yeah.
The moon, Selene, or other terms for the old crone who becomes renewed, the white goddess, I think was the one that Maurice Graves wrote about, it being the iconic mother myth, you know, the three stages. Yeah. But we're going to enjoy, I think, since you mentioned the crow in that one, a dark companion that you have talked about before.
Yes.
And you'll read the one, Dark Friends in Dark Times, which I think certainly shows the friendship that comes with anthropomorphizing creatures.
Yes, indeed. Dark Friends in Dark Times. I love to get to know the crows that roost and hammer on the roof over my head. I watch them swoop in, first appearing to fly straight at my window, then pulling up at the last. They are smarter than we'll ever know. The green world is the seen world, but no one knows it's there. We pretend to be separate, above, but it's the crows. They may be cockroaches of the air with their black feathers like the armored sides of a SWAT van, but I know they are poets and comedians. The sky, their endless metaphor, and we, the butt of the joke.
They are realists. Crows have to be realists.
It's true. And they're worth studying for that very thing. They remind us about what the important things are when it comes right down to it. And it's interesting to watch them in society with each other. Just to see that the way they react. I seldom see crows in solo. I always see crows in pairs. On my morning walks in the daylight, there's always one up on a wire and one down on the ground. It's like the one up high is keeping watch. The one down on the ground is doing whatever collecting needs to be done. It's just interesting for me to watch them. And to watch them do some of their aerial acrobatics. I remember when I was driving one morning, this is when I was living in the Mahow Valley, I was driving down to Chelan to work, and this crow came flying right at my windshield, and just as I thought didn't see me, it flipped over onto its back and then flipped over upright and swooped up over the windshield of my car. It was like it was toying with me. It was playing chicken, and then it just showed me this little trick right before it swooped up over the windshield of the car. It was just amazing.
And pretty good connection there.
Yeah, I've felt it for a long time. So.
Almost dying. No, I'm not.
Yeah, I'm glad. You thought I wasn't gonna make it, did you?
And there you've got your wonderful crow cup.
Oh yeah, there it
is. Which is one of the motifs of your morning show.
Yes it is. That's actually from the Twist River Pub.
Twist River, one of your biggest ones. The biggest you've got.
That's it There you go.
Well, crows and poets, let's have a listen to how they connect.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Crows and poets. Crows gathering in that far tree before sunup, a silhouette in the window, a shadow play without sound. I imagine a cacophony as the murderous Congress is convened. I smoke weed before first light for the pain that cuts short the walk, and watch the bent old man next door load his walker into the trunk. Why is he wearing golfing gloves? Gary Snyder is talking in favor of polygamy in an interview from 1965. He was 35 then. Experience pulls us out of our college of pure thought. Concepts are one thing, organic life with its imperfections quite another. Gary Snyder was 35 Now he is 90. Put that in your bong and smoke it.
Now, Gary Snyder.
Yes.
There are people with the name Gary Snyder that almost remind me of beat poets and philosophers, right?
Right. That is the Gary Snyder I am referring to.
That's the one, yes.
That's the one, yes.
And yet there was another one that reminded me of a golfer.
Oh, and Gary Player.
Player,
see. Gary Player.
Yeah, Gary Player. But yeah. It's just the ER on the end. But Gary Snyder I know well from a few books I've got. Yeah. No, he was a great beat poet. Of course, went environmental and ceased writing a lot of poetry, more writing about travels and environment and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's written a lot of prose pieces, but he put out his most recent book of poetry came out not more than 5 years ago, I don't think. It's called This Present Moment.
And so he's ancient of ancients now.
He is, and he's still with us. I'm not sure if he's still writing poetry, but he is still with us. And he wrote a book called Danger on Peaks, which I find to be just amazing, which starts with the recounting of his first trips up Mount St. Helens. When he was a teenager, he climbed Mount St. Helens for the first time and was actually coming down to Spirit Lake Lodge the day that the newspapers about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were posted on the bulletin boards of the Spirit Lake Lodge. And he recounts this vow that he took. He said, I vow on the permanence of Mount St. Helens to fight against this evil my whole life. And the next series of poems is him going back after Mount St. Helens blew up.
Oh.
You know, so it's kind of it's this strange recounting of an oath he took on the permanence of something that ended up not being permanent, and
right.
The kind of lessons that were generated from that lesson. So anyway,
explosive ideas there. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
he did find many wonders to write about from his travels. Yeah,
definitely.
He was a very thoughtful person, as beat poets went. Not so much concerned with just the urban blight or the problem of relationships, but really he was more expansive,
right?
And really thought about the planet from an early time. Yeah,
yes,
from a very early time. Because we are here together.
Sure.
And the last poem you read, which we have still on record there, Reassurance.
Yes.
Why not read about dawn? I think dawn is one of those simplistic poems that speaks very calmly and wisely, that no one can gainsay it in any way. There's nothing to interpret here.
Yeah.
You just let this be.
Right. Thank you so much for saying that. I appreciate that very much, David. Okay. Dawn. I wait while daylight tries its best. It isn't the crow who brings the dawn from his deep pockets of darkness, only the effortless roll of the ball, the spin of green and blue coming out of the shadows. This is the true morning. This is where creation starts. It doesn't need light to spark it, only curious eyes, searching heart, and spinning brain. When daylight finally rolls in, the work has already dawned.
So there you have Bill Davie, and a dawn for you to read or think or play every day you want. Hey, Bill, that was great.
Right.
Now, there's one here for J.W. I don't need to know who J.W. is unless you want to name the person for his listening's sake. But what? Two Worlds at Once is the poem.
Yes.
J.W.
J.W. is a songwriter friend of mine who I admire greatly, and someone I've known for many years. And it's just an observation that I made about one of his songs as I was listening to a revised version of it one night. And it's called Two Worlds at Once. He's added verses to his song about letting the birds fly, verses about his father. He is preparing for loss. He's out on the limb where music holds us upright, lets us say what life doesn't always allow. In songs, we can open veins of joy or sorrow that will not otherwise flow. And what a gift to have a voice for crying in the otherwise mute wilderness of just before the shoe drops, when we feel it slipping. It's amazing to hear him artfully let some of it go and hold some of it back. To watch him walk a tightrope over that fiery lake. To love his father in two worlds at once, the here and the after.
Well, he must be very, very happy to hear that. Well, you've read that for him and sent it to him, I suppose, have you not?
He has read it.
Yeah, what a lucky fellow to have you write poems in his regard like that.
That's one of my all-time favorites, I think.
Yeah. Well, as poetry goes, there's generally poems that talk about returning. And the one that you've entitled Finding My Way Back is getting close to that sort of idea. And we also have your reassurance poem that we cannot miss that one, because I believe that one is very suitable. I think it was the conclusion of your book,
is.
Was it not?
Yes, yeah. It is.
Well, let's do Finding My Way Back first.
Okay. Finding My Way Back. Now that I am finally in love, my previous neediness has a defined shape. Fingernails grow more quickly and packages arrive on time. Has circumstance always affected things so? The mail, the bus schedule, the dentist appointment all have good news in them when seen from the balcony of love. This kind of intimate relation bends time around corners, reheats cold teacups, tells fortunes at the farmer's market for a dollar, and then gives the dollar back. In the mornings, after I've told my tales to paper, I go back to bed and hold her. 20 minutes between the alarms, to feel her ribs expand with breathing, to feel her breasts compress against my chest, to run my hands across her warmth. This doesn't seem to bother her at all. In fact, she reciprocates, finding nerve endings I've forgotten about. She ties tiny knots in my memory so I can find my way back through various fogs of age and forgetting to the blaze of our continual beginning.
A love poem. yes. Did you write songs of love in your early days? Or were your songs more critical of society? What do you feel about the way you've come to a poem like this?
I have written love songs over the years, but I've also written, I think I've written songs very much like the poems I've written on a variety of different subjects and focuses. But definitely love songs have been part of my repertoire, at least. And most especially in the last 13 years since Diane and I got together. We didn't get together until we were 50 years old, so it was a miracle. And it seems to be continuing to be kind of ongoing. So there's plenty of material there for poems and songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, you're a very lucky man.
I agree with you 100%. I am totally lucky.
And it comes through very much in some of those poems that are addressed somewhat to her help and her assistance in your life, let alone the lifting of you up in ways such as you've just written there.
Good.
Yeah. Well, you had one poem where the crows showed up.
Right.
Those glossy black birds on the roof. But you have most definitely an intimate relationship with crows.
Yes.
And why not read one of your crow poems just to show how you attack nature or approach nature.
Okay, well, let me see here. Which one do I want to? Is there a particular one that you think of would be a representative?
Well, it's not hard to find them. Some of them are there in the title. Crows on gives a description, I think, of a variety.
Yes, okay, here we go. Crows on. Crow on the lid of a car, picking at the cracks between roof and door, around the antenna, picking out bits too tiny to see from my third-story window across the way. Crow on the fence behind the cars, chases off a squirrel, drops to the other side, comes back with something white, like half a French fry, takes it to the rooftop where friends drop by unexpected, so he flies off for private breakfast. Crow on the roof over my head is all sound, a Morse code of cracking and digging, endless thuds and taps. Expect her to drop through onto my desk at any moment, both of us startled, neither of us strangers.
Yeah, I think poets get to feel that they know some creatures, perhaps through writing about them, but observation brings that intimacy.
Right, and that has been especially true during the pandemic, where I have sat at this table right here behind me, looking out this particular window in my little writer's garret here, which is on the third story, and the crows are just all around. And they're always swooping at the window and then pulling up at the last moment and landing on the roof right over the top of my head. And I can hear them up there pecking and tapping and digging and doing whatever that is their business to do. And then when I go for my morning walks, there are always a couple of crow couples that will follow me, one down on the ground, one up on a wire. And they just kind of, I notice them all the way down to the end of my walk and then all the way home. You can never know if it's the same crows every day, but you like to think that it is. If you have that kind of mindset. And the crows have been identified as my totem animal as well. So they've kind of just always been there for me. So
right.
I always notice the crows.
When Wallace Stevens wrote that 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird,
right,
makes you think, there are so many blackbirds.
Yes.
That was it just a black? Bird, the black bird that he was writing about there, or the black birds.
Yes.
Many ways to look at them.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think they're fascinating creatures, crows, ravens too.
Oh, yes.
But the social life of crows, we can get to know if we get out there in the streets these days. They become very much urban hobos.
They have become that. I've watched them use tools. I've watched them use tools to take a little stick and use it to dig grubs out of the trunk of a tree or something like that. They're amazing creatures to watch. Once when I was living up in the Methow, I was walking on a trailless area near where I lived, and I came upon a dead deer, and there was a golden eagle, a red-tailed hawk, a magpie, a raven, and a crow all feeding off the same carcass all together. And one would kind of chase the others off for a moment, and they'd all just kind of come back. Then another one would kind of fly off and come back. It was one of those moments where I was just like, okay, all right, there's a lot of communication that I'm not privy to going on here. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yes, they are very social. And birds, made animals, of course, do that too. But birds especially show that they're taking turns.
Right.
The feast,
exactly.
The feast of the roadkill or the exactly. accidental kill.
It
well, how about
sharing.
How about if we conclude now with reassurance? And I'm sure this will feel like a very good bedding for the conclusion.
All right. Again, this is the last poem in the book. This is called Reassurance. There will be another quiet time when our greatest effort is not being exerted and our grasp on what we have is not threatened. Rules change, people and places come and go, but there is a pattern here, a cycle, a circle, a tide, and somewhere a moon. Just because we are vulnerable doesn't mean we are doomed. Think of the great pyramids out in all that open, or again, the moon. Their persistent locations increase their exposure to threat, and also to our marveling at what holds them in place.
Bill Davey, this is Sound Poetry, and we have enjoyed immensely your reading of some fine verse, and is particularly the way that you find ways to comfort the reader in what you are exposing here as sometimes difficult times, including the life, the comfortable life of your childhood, but especially as in this one, to give us the sense of persistence, and that there is a time to come in which there may be exposures of threat, but there also may be cessations with our finding a way to adjust even to the worst of times.
Yes.
And reasons, thank you so much for those poems that can help people in that adjustment.
Wow,
Bill,
thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. This is Radio Tacoma. You've been listening to Sound Poetry. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and you have been listening to Bill Davey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.